This is Deborah Roberts, co-anchor of 2020. We're bringing you a true crime series from our colleagues at ABC Studios called Wild Crime, Murder in the Rocky Mountains. Here's episode 3, A Third Victim.
Wild places. Wilder crimes. These are the stories of the elite team that solves them in the most dangerous crime scenes in the world. Our national parks.
He's a danger. This man has killed, supposedly, two wives.
It looks like a freak accident.
He learned that the death of his wife equals money at the end of the day. He hasn't had a job since 1992.
I could have been the third victim.
You never call your old
brother-in-law. Oh my gosh! I haven't seen through this guy.
The last thing he wanted was him going home to his child. We felt like we were dealing with a ticking time bomb.
Within days of Tony dying, the park received a letter about his first wife, Lynn Henthorne. And it was an anonymous letter, but it said his first wife passed away in suspicious circumstances.
But I thought, oh my gosh, you know, this is two wives for Harold that have died now.
A man having one wife die is tragic. A man having two wives die is suspicious. And I said, I think we've got a case. Early on in the investigation, Harold very quickly got an attorney, and we knew we were never going to get another interview with him again. We needed to build a case on purely circumstantial evidence, which is really problematic. You know, of course you want a direct witness, but the only witness is Harold himself, who was not talking to us. We may know in our hearts that Harold had killed her, but we had to start at the very beginning and slowly build our case. And then also building as much as we could the history of Harold, Harold's comings and goings. So we started questioning, did he have a mistress? Did he have another family somewhere?
All these trips out of town, supposedly, I've seriously thought that there may be somebody else involved in this.
At that point, I had gotten cell records, and one of the individuals that kept popping up in a cell record was Grace Rochelle. So Grace Rochelle was Harold's former sister-in-law. Lynn Rochelle, his first wife's brother's ex-wife. Now, Harold and Grace are not related in any way, but Harold and Grace texted and called each other all the time.
Harold's relationship with Grace Rochelle and her four daughters starts off as totally understandable, with Harold being a more doting uncle and brother-in-law than just about anybody you'd ever meet.
We had to ask the question, was Grace Harold's lover? Is this why he killed Tony?
They were very suspicious of me. They were like, we're checking you out to see if you have had a romantic relationship with Harold. And I'm like, I am an open book, and I will tell you everything I know. I was not romantically involved with Harold. In December of 2007, my husband, Kevin, and I separated for the first time. So that was hard. That was difficult. We went through bankruptcy, foreclosure. We lost our home right before Christmas. I was devastated. I did not want my marriage to end. I'd lost everything. I mean, I had no savings, no nothing at that point. And I thought of my girls.
When I was going through my divorce with Grace, Harold was involved in trying to separate my children's allegiance from me and put it on himself.
Harold saw, I believe, an exact way to fit in and bond with four girls, which was the fun, goofy uncle.
Harold really began to step it up. He told me he helped single women get on their feet. Tony was a part of it, and Lynn was before that. That's what they did.
Grace sat with us for 5 hours and talked with us. We pretty quickly determined that she was not Harold's paramour. Grace was concerned about her children's financial future. She had just gotten divorced, and Harold said, I tell you what, why don't you get an insurance policy and we'll make the girls a beneficiary.
At first, the insurance policy seemed like a gracious gift that I could accept because it was for my girls.
Okay, girls, you're being recorded. I'm gonna try a still shot.
Yeah, you know, there's that one. And we thought it was fun at the time.
Yeah.
This is one of the things he would do is like, you know, the fun uncle.
Yeah,
the challenges.
I talked about that earlier, that he liked.
There's an odd sense of, like, we were the family that maybe Harold always wanted.
There's another Christmas one where he just looks like it's just
always
like.
Always looks like our dad.
Yeah. It was like he was trying to insert himself.
By Harold, and
like he was so present in our family.
He was on the phone, I remember, calling all the time. He'd call my mother.
Hey, crazy girls. Harold calling about 9 o'clock or so on Wednesday morning. Just trying to call and get back in touch with you. It's been way too long. So give me a call back or text back if you would, and leave me a time and a day. That'd be a good time for me to try to call you.
So in about March of 2010, the divorce was final, and I'm going to move to Texas. I was getting ready to take on a new job, and Harold and I got into basically a big fight about it. He didn't want me to take this job, and Harold was trying to get us to come to Colorado. He gets really mad at me. He's like, you won't return my phone calls. And I'm like, because you want to talk for hours. Harold, I don't have time.
Grace, Harold calling. I'm scheduling these. Harold and Haley calling you. Crazy girl. It is Harold calling you about 3 o'clock my time. 7:45 right when my time.
I'm a mom. I'm trying to work all these jobs, start this new job.
You never call your old brother-in-law when you're dating.
And he came back at me with, after all I've spent investing in you, pouring all of our knowledge, all of our information, and you're not grateful. I saw him as being very controlling at a whole new level. So I called his broker and I said, I am not going through with this policy. No way. I'm done.
And then we dropped the bomb on her that Harold never canceled this policy. The policy had Harold Henthorne as the primary beneficiary. Her daughters weren't mentioned at all. And the policy was $400,000.
They tell me, there is an active policy on you. I said, that can't be possible. Yeah, there was one, but we got in a fight. I told him to cancel it. That was done. What are you telling me? She said, there's one for $400,000. And it's paid through till August of this year. I was just shocked. I definitely felt that I could have been the third victim. I'm like, oh my gosh. You're gonna take me away from my girls? These girls that you've loved, that you've held since they were babies? What have I done? How have I not seen through this guy?
She was a means to an end, another paycheck.
This policy was created just prior to Tony's death. So this is not just after Tony died, but before Tony died.
My mom was grieving the loss of her marriage and her family, falling apart. And I think Harold was witnessing that, and he was already planning to get my mother close so that he could do the same thing he's done to Tony and Lynn.
I was thinking how he tried to get me to Colorado, how he tried to get me to move there.
When you first start investigating someone and you don't know anything about them, and then you start deep diving into them, my vision of who he is definitely changed from sort of this sort of blank-faced unknown to I definitely think that he is an evil person. I think he's truly evil. Early on in the investigation, Yvonne Berlay, she relayed to me a story that had happened pretty much a year before Tony was killed. She said that this wasn't the first time something bad happened to Tony. Looking at the timing of that, we believe that was his first attempt to try to kill Tony.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the very large pieces of this case was insurance. We had found out that Harold had a $400,000 insurance policy on Grace Rochelle. And what we uncovered was that there actually was a considerable amount of life insurance on Lynn Henthorn also. More than the family actually was led to believe by Harold. Several months before Lynn died, he and Lynn got insurance on each other, $300,000 policy. But she already had an insurance policy on her. So why this extra insurance at that time? He received over $600,000 from her death. And then we see from the very beginning, Harold gets insurance on Tony. Harold had told Ranger Faraday in his interview that Tony had one insurance policy on her for $1 million. Well, any investigator knows, don't believe the husband when they say there's only one policy. So I submitted a request to this sort of clearinghouse for insurance policies. And I said, does anybody have any insurance policies for Tony Henthorn?
I'm Steve Jensen, and I'm an insurance fraud investigator. I was signed by the insurance carrier. When I initially received the assignment, I realized that there was a tremendous amount of red flags in this case. I'm sure that there were at least four insurance carriers who had issued policies.
He's doing this slowly and over time. There's $1.5 million in 2001, a year after they get married. There's another $1.5 million in 2005, after Haley is born. There's another $1.5 million in 2008.
And so that door led to another door, which led to another door, which eventually led to $4.7 million worth of insurance.
He's going to make a small fortune if Tony's dead.
So all of these insurance policies led up to, at the end of the day, Harold getting a lot of money if these women around him died.
With Tony, looking back, that's the thing that is the most upsetting about this entire story, is we know now that he probably didn't love her.
I've known Harold for a short period of time, but he's warmed my heart. He does and says all the right things that a father-in-law looks for.
He's a great salesman.
If we could have known then what we know now, we could have changed things.
After Tony moved to Colorado, Harold started controlling her communication with the family. He would call her cell phone and it would go to Harold's. So Harold would pick up.
I could hear in the background, but I couldn't talk to her like I used to do.
Birthday girl, Yvonne.
Yvonne Berdelet goes a whole decade without talking in private with her daughter because Harold was so oppressively there.
He had to control almost every situation he was in. And if he couldn't control the situation, he would get angry, or he would get freaked out, or he would cut that person off.
Everything about Harold was controlling. I mean, every little detail. After Tony and Harold got married, we saw them less and less. She dropped out of her choir that she loved. She quit teaching Sunday school, and he's the one that called us and told us that. He had asked her to give that up because it was taking away from their marriage. That was one of the first glimpses into his personality. So we started seeing things being taken from her, one painful step at a time. Looking back, we should have dug into that more. It was not normal.
All right, Tony's next. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Merry Christmas. If any of that flew in last evening from Denver, Colorado.
Looking at the two wives of Harold Hinthorne, both women were described as extremely loving Christian women, successful, strong women, but at the same time, very manipulated by Harold, very controlled by Harold, that Harold controlled the relationship.
One of the things that Tony's personal experience with Christianity taught her was that women are to look to their husbands as the authority in a marriage. That control is exactly what Harold was after in almost every relationship in his life, but most especially with his wives.
I think he took her confidence away from her. I think he took her self-being away from her. I later found out from the neighbors, they said her, you know, her face was empty. She didn't smile. It was kind of like a blank stare. She definitely was not the person that she was when she left Mississippi to go to Colorado.
Early on in one of the interviews with Yvonne Berdelet, she said, I have to tell you something Tony told me. The Hinthornes had a cabin up at Grand Lake. They had been up at the cabin and it was late at night and something happened. This cabin, remote area, one night in May 2011, it's him, Tony, and Haley.
And nobody else is around. Haley's already asleep. And Harold, for whatever reason, wants to clean up outside, almost in the middle of the night.
It's a small one-story cabin with a fairly sizable deck that goes to a sloping area. There's a broken light. Harold was outside on the deck and he called Tony to come help him.
And she was bending over to pick it up.
And what happens next, nobody really knows for sure.
Something hits her in the back of the neck.
They called 911. This was 10 o'clock at night. And in May at Grand Lake, it's pitch black out. Her story to the medic is that there was a broken light and she was picking up the broken light bulb when her husband threw a piece of wood over the deck.
And it looked like a freak accident.
Harold was going around telling people, no big deal, whatever else. But, you know, we found out later that, you know, Tony's actually crying in the ambulance on the way over. And she said, well, what really happened to me?
Tony ended up getting transferred to Denver. And the final outcome was that she suffered damage to her cervical spine.
She has a fractured vertebrae. She has lingering numbness in her left hand. That's a big deal for a surgeon, and that's a bad outcome for an accident.
So you've got to ask yourself a couple questions. Why was she down there picking up a piece of glass at 10 o'clock at night, and why did he throw a piece of wood over the railing while she's down there picking up glass?
There's no police report, right? There's no crime.
It's just too eerie to ignore. Again, we have Harold's wife in a remote location. He's the only witness, late at night. And then varying stories from him surrounding the situation to different people.
At one point, he says it's a 2x4. At one point, he says it's a 2x6. At one point, he tells a paramedic it's 20 feet long. We don't know, but it's big enough to do a lot of damage, and he's throwing it at her from a height.
And she said, if I had not reached to get whatever it was on the floor, I think that it would have killed me on the spot.
I really believe that was his first attempt at murder.
And so as an investigator, you're looking at this, you're like, what else is he capable of? And that's what we really needed to dive into. After we sat with Grace Rochelle, we pretty much ruled out the fact that she was part of Harold killing Tawny. But we still didn't know exactly what he was doing on these business trips. Routinely, he would travel on Thursdays, you know, a couple times a month, according to the nannies and the witnesses who we interviewed. So we started questioning, what was he doing when he was traveling? Was it really for work? Was this reason to leave on these quote-unquote business trips a contribution to Tony's death?
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
The incident with the beam at the cabin is in perfect alignment with the other two incidents, the one with Lynn Henthorne and then when Tony Henthorne did die. Late at night, remote location. A pot of gold at the end of that rainbow, which involved the death of his wife.
It was a deeper level of just evil. And I just thought, this is what he does. This is how he makes a living. This is his craft.
Early on, we were working with an assistant United States attorney, but he ended up leaving and taking another job. So we needed to do a presentation to the United States Attorney's office to see who we could get assigned to the case. We thought it might be a tough sell. And it was at that time that we got assigned Sunita and Valeria.
My name is Valeria Spencer, and I'm an assistant United States attorney, which means I'm a federal prosecutor.
My name is Sunita Hazra. I was the lead prosecutor for the prosecution of Harold Henthorne.
Because Rocky Mountain National Park is a national park, it is federal land.
Which means that the federal government prosecutes them, not the state.
And I said, look, you guys need to come up to Rocky Mountain National Park and see the scene. You have to see the scene. So we hike up Deer Mountain and then we start going off trail. And they're like, wait a minute. Well, this doesn't make sense. I was like, see?
We just turned off at nowhere. There was no indication that there was a spot to turn off.
His story that he told the Rangers is they went off to have some romantic time.
There's just no way. We knew Tony Henthorne had bad knees. We knew they were in their mid-50s. You know, it just didn't make sense.
And then we wander through the woods, and then we get to the lunch spot. And they had the aha moment. They looked down that rocky slope, and they said there's no reason for Harold and Tony to be here.
And as soon as Sunita and I saw the site, we were totally on board with them and said, okay, we're in 100%. What are we going to do to prove this case now?
We started tracking Harold's movements and tailing him to see where he would go. But he stayed local. He never left the area. So the question was, what was he doing with his time now that he had killed Tony? Is he a flight risk? What is he doing? Who is he meeting with?
The investigators didn't have a smoking gun, but there's all sorts of places where evidence might be lurking.
Are there bank accounts we don't know about? And there's also a question, were there other women that he may have victimized? So we needed to seize his cell phone. We wanted to seize his computer. We wanted to know what files and documents that he had. And so we realized we were going to have to do a search warrant for his house.
So sometimes you take those things, like the computers, you don't know what you're going to find on them. And then other times you find things that you didn't think of.
And then they find it. And what they find is evidence of the lie. The biggest lie.
Every time you do a search warrant, you know it's going to be a long day. We ring the doorbell. We can't see in the house. There's no movements. As we're sitting there, the garage door opens. And so we go up to the car and tell him, Mr. Henthorne, we have a search warrant for your house. Please step out of the car. It was a very nice house, not a lot of Tony presence there. When you enter his office, he controls it, it's his sanctum, and it was full of stuff.
What Harold was a pack rat, and so every single piece of paper from the last 20 years was in there.
There was file cabinets full, thousands of files, the boat, the cabin, how much is in this account, that account.
So there were a lot of nuggets there that Harold didn't really count on or, you know, figure out that we would be able to find in that house.
There were tax returns, which were very interesting to us because pretty early into the investigation, I became suspicious about Harold and his job.
We didn't think he was totally unemployed, but we thought he was inflating what he earned.
I mean, Harold's employment history is really hard to figure out, right? Because after college, after graduate school at University of Kentucky, he does get a real job at Chevron in Denver.
For some reason, Harold couldn't get a project done. His response would be excuse after excuse. His supervisor eventually ran out of patience.
And he was gonna get fired, but ended up quitting. At some point, he's selling diamonds. Though how successfully, no one is really sure. And then in the early 90s, he went to Colorado Christian, a university where he did some fundraising work.
And because he wasn't very good at it, the supervisor said, we're going to have to let you go. And he came back the next day and said, oh, I'm resigning because I'm going to start my own business. That was the last known position.
I'm a fundraising consultant. I work with nonprofits, whether it be churches, schools, or hospitals.
Over the course of 20 years, not only is he not set the world on fire. Not only has he not closed all these deals, he's talked about every year in Christmas letters.
And I have one in the suburb of Las Vegas as well.
But Harold made almost nothing for two decades. Almost $0.
The tax returns show Harold was making absolutely nothing and pretending that he actually had some income.
He's not a businessman. He hasn't had a job since 1992.
He had posed for almost 20 years as somebody he's not and worked really hard at it. Going on trips and hiring a nanny for his daughter and creating business cards and having a notepads with development services on the notepads.
It was as big a lie as you can tell about who you were professionally. And he'd been living that for a long, long time. And somehow had gotten away with it.
It was clear that this case was becoming more and more complex, and the FBI agent who was working with Beth Schott was moved to another assignment. And so Beth's one woman up at the park handling everything. She was stretched pretty thin, and we knew that we were going to need help with furthering this investigation down the road.
I reached out to Special Agent Johnny Grusing of the FBI and asked him if he would jump in and assist and work with Beth. And I picked Johnny because he has a lot of experience doing serial killer cases for the FBI. Really a methodical, good investigator.
My name is Jonathan Grusing. I go by Johnny. I had not worked with the Park Service before, and I did not know they had investigative agents. I just thought these were the very kind, happy guys that pointed you to don't litter and, you know, protect your forest land sort of thing.
He later told me that he kind of felt a little sorry for me, that here I was sort of spinning my wheels on this case.
So I asked a couple of questions. Did Harold have any prior arrest history, criminal history? No. Can you prove the difference between a push and a fall? And they said, no, you can't. I said, well, I'm happy to look into it, but just because he's a liar, as you guys know, the jury doesn't have to find him to be a murderer.
And so we hiked up, we did all of our work, we showed him all the areas, he looked at everything, and he didn't say anything. And so then Sunita and I were like, oh no, you know, here's a new person to see it with fresh eyes, and he's not seeing it the way we do. Johnny, being who he is, very quiet man, doesn't say anything. Can't remember exactly when it was. It might have been in the car on the way back. He was like, that man killed his wife. He shoved her off that cliff, and we were like, yes!
So Beth had done a tremendous amount of work getting all the search warrants and returns from Harold's phone, from his computer, the house. They could prove that Harold was lying. They could prove that he had an insurable interest to kill Tony, but you couldn't prove that he killed Tony. Knowing that time is of the essence, if Harold truly killed not only Tony, but his first wife, Lynn, and we had him still running around in society, we needed to act quickly.
Yes. I'll be all back. What'd you see?
Friends and family told us that once Tony had Haley, it was almost like Tony was a third wheel in that family.
It was our theory that he wanted a child very desperately. And once he got that child, he didn't need Tony anymore. He had the person that he could control 1,000% above any wife or anyone else in his life, and that was his daughter.
So you wanted to build the case, but you also knew someone who we believed had murdered two different people and was living with a young child was out there. So we all felt like we were dealing with a ticking time bomb.
Tony was right under here. We've got this guy, and we think he killed both his wives. And he most likely had an inner circle of people that weren't willing to talk yet. People that I knew had critical pieces to tell us that may even link Lynn's death and Tony's death.
And the opportunity is going to be these remote locations that he brings these women to.
Yeah.
We did try to interview his family, and they refused an interview with us. So that has some really eerie similarities. The information that we did piece together from his childhood was little bits and pieces from friends that did speak with us.
My name is Myra Whitener, and I went to junior high school with Harold. We remained friends throughout our whole lives. For all of us, honestly, he was obnoxious, but you just kind of overlook that because he was so charming too. Harold didn't want to go home a lot. I think that's probably why he hung out at our house.
Casting around for ideas of why Harold is who he is, you can be way too simplistic, but also you can probably be right at the same time. And I think it all comes down to his dad.
Our understanding was that his father was abusive to him as a child, and we don't know exactly to what extent.
He was an alcoholic. He was violent. It was bad.
That's one thing Harold always said, I will never drink, and I will never hit a woman, he said. Which is why it's shocking.
I'm sure that there were some early warning signs, maybe even going back to childhood. I'm Brianna Fox. I study the criminal behavior and basically why people commit crimes in specific ways. I think there's a few different reasons why he was so drawn to women that were, you know, loving, caring from these wonderful families.
And if you're from that kind of house, you don't have an example of how to build a good life. You're reaching and grabbing for everything you can.
Well, Harold always wanted to have a family. He wanted to be a family man.
If you're going to be a good predator, if you're going to be a good wolf in sheep's clothing, you have to look like a sheep. Harold had to condition himself to show emotion.
Lynn and Tony were loving Christian women. And I think Harold used that.
I think for him, they were props in his facade.
And he's all about presentation. He needed everybody to know how smart and how powerful and how rich he was.
Everything he's told me about his jobs and who knows about his education, who knows if anything he's ever said is true. He has lied to me about everything.
He lied so much that he forgot who he lied to.
People like Harold, they're compulsive liars. So they will tell you story one, and if you raise your eyebrows or if you blink too long, then they'll go to story two. They could care less what anybody else believes as long as you tell them you believe the story.
He would tell different versions of the story about Lynn's death, and then he would tell different versions of the story about Tony's death.
A narcissist has no empathy for people around him, and every even little statement has to go towards a building up of the perception or image of that person.
Having never met him, it's difficult to with full certainty say exactly what, you know, he may qualify as. But conning and manipulation of others, narcissism and grandiosity, pathological lying, very low empathy, taking responsibility for action, constantly blaming others. These are things that throughout this case, we just see not one time, but consistently appearing over and over and over again. The pattern is very strong and consistent that he shows many traits and features consistent with psychopathy of being a psychopath.
I think Harold is different than most psychopaths because he's not someone who's going to hurt a stranger. He's fine to strangers. But I believe that the closer you are to Harold, the more likelihood that he's going to harm or kill you.
There was concern after Tony died that Harold's attention to Haley was almost too much, that it was obsessive. And some friends and family voiced concern that they were worried for Haley's welfare.
The Bertolais, their main concern is Haley. At one point, the Bertolais have this plan.
We were pretending that we were supporting Harold.
But on the other hand, we were an inside source for information for Beth Schott and the FBI. We're all playing this game. And the whole time you're thinking, this man murdered my sister.
And Haley was going to be alone with Harold without their influence if they confronted him. So that scared them, I think.
It seems very likely, based upon the pattern of behaviors that Harold was exhibiting over all of these years, Haley, she could have easily been at risk. Or if she was saying, no, I don't want to live this way anymore, that could have ended with her, you know, potentially ending up just like her mother.
This is Deborah Roberts. Harold Hinthorn maintains he did not kill either of his wives. The series was produced by Lone Wolf Media for ABC News Studios. Join us next week for the conclusion of Wild Crime, Murder in the Rocky Mountains from ABC Studios. You can find the series streaming on Hulu, where you can also find 2020. Tune in to ABC Friday nights at 9 for all new broadcast episodes of 2020.